Park and Peter Wheatley from University of Bristol have shown that bees can sense the electric field that surrounds a flower. They can even learn to distinguish between fields produced by different floral shapes or use them to work out whether a flower has been recently visited by other bees. Flowers aren't just visual spectacles and smelly beacons, they are also electric billboards and of quotes. So, scientists have been able to know from that about the electric side of pollination since 1960s. Do you, Dr. Roy, have anything to add in that area?
Well, I mean, not particularly. We have, as biologists go deeper and deeper into this subject, they realize that evolution has used a lot of properties. There are animals that can detect magnetic fields. That offers them a method of returning to a particular site, and the ability to detect electrical fields also developed in biology. You know, life finds a way, and not every creature utilizes every aspect of science, but given enough opportunities and billions of years of evolution, it's not bizarre that electrostatic fields are detectable in small creatures. Not much use if a buffalo were able to detect an electromagnetic field. But for a small object like these, where it's easier to bioengineer something like that, then certainly. I mean, to the degree that everyone's kind of taken a balloon and rubbed it on their head and kind of charged up the balloon and then put it onto their arm, and their arm hairs jump up towards the balloon, and you can feel that sensation. So it's sort of a similar idea, but it's a little bit more finesse than bees and flowers.
The point source is a single identifiable localized source of something. Point source has negligible extent, distinguishing it from other source of geometry. So we have a point source that is electrically charged. Then we see, what is the difference between electrostatic and electromagnetic force, right? But first we should see, okay, so the electromagnetic force is the difference between electrostatic and electromagnetic force is that the electrostatic forces refer to the forces between charges which are not moving relative to each other, whereas electromagnetic force refers to electrostatic forces as well as other forces between charges, and magnetic fields where they may be moving relative to each other, which actually is the same what you said prior to that.
Yes. Let me see if I have the repeater. Okay. So, again, a electric field that's not moving produces an electric field. A charged particle that's not moving produces a static electric field. If it moves, it produces, in addition, a magnetic field at a constant velocity. If it moves at a non-constant accelerated velocity, it produces an electromagnetic field. All three, the electrostatic field, the magnetic field, and the electromagnetic field, all the forces mitigated between all three is from electromagnetic photons. That's the force. There's no separate force for electrostatic forces, for magnetic forces, or for electromagnetic forces. They're all the force carrier for all three is the photon, is electromagnetic packet.
Okay, so before we come back to bees, as you said, then I try to repeat it. I'm not sure if I would be able to repeat it the way that you do it, but yes, the electrostatic forces refers to the forces between electric charges which are not moving relative to each other. But how can the bee produce electromagnetic wave, not electrostatic charge, electromagnetic wave? And correct me if I'm wrong. Electromagnetic forces describe any interaction that takes place due to at the fundamental level an exchange of photons. So electromagnetic forces include electrostatic forces. Right or wrong?
Oh, yeah, like I said, the creator for all of the three pseudo forces, static electric, magnetic, and electromagnetic, are all the same, the photon. These produce mostly electromagnetic waves because, as again, they have these very thin, fragile wings and air friction, the same way that if you rub a balloon against your hair, it will pick up charges. So you'll develop static electric charges just from air resistance. And then on top of it, the bees are moving those wings back and forth in an ever-accelerating manner. So again, you have a bunch of charged wings that are moving at an irregular accelerated velocity, and that's how you produce electromagnetic waves.
How you should I say, because the last time I said, no, you're wrong, which I didn't mean you're wrong, it's just my inability to formulate English properly. I never wanted to say that. So I do apologize for the last time, last week, that I said that. But Dick was using I have a problem with that. Let me just. So I'm going to use the formulation, I have a problem with that. And thank you, Dr. Roy, for pointing me if I'm not properly using the English language. I'm going to give you the quote, which is in language that is not familiar to me, so don't laugh from it. Bees generate sound not only through the movement of their wings, but also with their trochaic muscles, although they use the muscle to move their wings, they can uncouple their wings to produce heat and generate acoustic signal. So there's no words about electricity. Electricity is somewhere else. So I'm going to finish the quote. Traveling sound waves have both pressure and the particle movement components. Sound waves are measured by their frequency hertz or cycles per second. The frequency of sound waves is heard as a pitch. A higher wave frequency creates a higher pitch. Honeybees produce many frequencies of vibration and sound from less than 10 to more than 1,000 hertz. So far, it happened to be shown that they can detect sound frequencies up to 500 hertz. Yeah, end of quote. Okay, so no words about the wings collect the charge. There is something else on the bee that does that. Back to you, Dr. Roy. Do you know what is it?
Well, it sounds like we're kind of discussing apples and oranges. Sound pressure, sound acoustics, sound, is not the same as electromagnetic waves. I mean, they have wave properties, but they're different. Sound is a pressure wave of a given medium, air, produced by the movement of some object, be it a wing or a muscle or what have you. But sound waves do not kind of spontaneously generate electromagnetic waves. So in that discussion, they're discussing a completely different topic from what I would understand. How do bees make sounds and detect sounds, which is fine and dandy. But the idea of how electromagnetic waves are created from the movement of bees. And you'll notice on the video that the signals come from bees that are flapping their wings furiously, not from bees that are just sitting around doing nothing. So the best idea that I know of for what's eliciting that is these little fragile wings are sort of well known to produce static charges. And when you flap them back and forth rapidly, you're accelerating those charges. And by definition, accelerated electrical charges produce electromagnetic waves. There might be other causes for electromagnetism, but that seems to be the most obvious in this particular case.
Anybody else who could share the information about the bees collecting or producing electromagnetic waves?
What frequency is it? What? WS1?
Repeat again.
When they detect the wings flapping on the bees, what frequency are they detecting? You know, they'd be able to tell how many times the wings are going up and down per second.
That I'm not sure, but I assume that if we tend to agree with Dr. Roy, that would be up to 1,000 hertz, so 1 kilohertz. But in reality, I believe the frequency is much higher. So there is something on the bee. I'm going to give you another quote. Bees and flowers are oppositely charged. Without even trying, bees build up a positive charge on their bodies as they fly. Flowers are negatively charged, and that makes their pollen stick to the bees through static electricity. But the electric field is more just than static charge. And when we have a moving electric field, then we have electromagnetic waves. So what is on the body of the bee that can produce electromagnetic waves if we just put them aside wings? Enter.
Well, I would assume, let me check that I have the receiver. Okay. I would assume that the major cause is the wings. It's a large surface area, it's very, very thin. Air resistance is flowing around it when it's moving, so that's a very strong indicator that there's electric charge, electrostatic charge being produced. To a lesser extent, there are small hairs on bees, and so as they fly, there's a degree of air resistance on those types of systems, so you'll have some additional electrostatic charges being produced when the bees are in motion. That would be my surmise.
Okay. Bees have very, very, very short and very tiny hair on their body. And that hair is a collector of electrostatic charge. Now, when you have bees visiting different fields, that guy from University of Bristol said, that field distinguishes between them, the other fields of floral shapes, of different floral shapes. So the bees are able to recognize if other bees were recently visiting that area. So we're talking about the level of electrostatic charge, if I may assume, but I'm not sure. Let me jump. Now, of course, it's my assumption, but well, I think if I'm right, we have a swarm of bees having a different level of electrostatic charge, and they exchange the charge. Actually, we we're talking about a moving charge. Then moving charge is electromagnetic wave. Is that more or less right, Dr. Roy?
It has to be an accelerating electric charge. If it's moving at a constant velocity, just as an electromagnet works, you only produce a magnetic field, not an electromagnetic field.
Anybody has an opinion? Okay. So, I didn't get, because from the time that when I sent you the email, to the time that TechNet started was like 40 minutes, I didn't see exactly the explanation how the electromagnetic wave is being produced, but I assume that also the movement of the hair and exchange of charge between bees that stick together, they bounce on each other, may produce those electromagnetic waves. So I'm not sure, but it's very much puzzling to me.
Well, again, it's not that I'm an insect specialist, so I'm just kind of trying to draw the best conclusions, at least the way my mind works. Is that the degree of acceleration, deacceleration, is what's producing most of the electromagnetic emission. And you're getting a lot more activity in the beating of electrostatically charged wings than you are on electrostatically charged bees kind of slowly hovering and flying around. They're certainly not operating at a constant velocity, but the acceleration, deceleration of flying bees, the whole body, is probably less significant than the massive acceleration, deceleration going on at a rapid rate of their wings, keeping them afloat.
I was thinking that their short hair, when they bounce on each other, they exchange the static electricity between themselves, and each individual hair is moving too. But whatever. Anybody has opinion? Okay. For many years, it was thought that bees were totally deaf to airborne vibration sound. However, it has been shown that honey bees can detect the air particle movement associated with airborne sound. And they do that also using Johnson organ, a crotodonal organ in the adenal pendicel cell. Crotodonal organs are in category of mechanoreceptor sensoria that respond to stimuli ranging from gross motor movement to sound and convert those to neural impulses. The major three types of crotodonal organs include the tympanal organ, Johnson organ, and subgenital organ. Oh boy, that was difficult for me to read. But anyhow, my question after reading that, how do the bees communicate?
You asking me?
Yes, because I don't know that. I don't know the answer. It's just something that I wasn't able to research.
Okay. Most of the studies have gone into discussing that bees actually do a little dance when a single bee is inspecting the surroundings and he finds a patch of flowers that can be used to feed the hive. He runs back to the hive and he starts to do this little three-dimensional dance, which seems to represent the vector qualities to get to that patch of flowers. So as far as I'm aware, the primary method that bees use to communicate with other bees is the dance. Now, I'm sure that's a gross simplification. I'm sure there are movements and gestures that they make between each other. I'm sure there are pheromones that they produce and all kinds of more vague things. But the big thing that almost everyone shows you in documentaries is the dance of the honeybee to each other.
Okay, thank you for that. Actually, I found the quote sending about hair. The sensory structure is suitable for perceiving near field sound signals of hair sensilia or the antennae. These, which had learned to respond to sound, were then manipulated by removing one of or both antennae, or fixing a certain joint in the antenna, or removing sensory. So actually, what they're saying here is that they found in 1991 that bees can hear the frequencies, low frequencies up to 500 hertz, and that is done with their hair, sensory hair, which are called anyhow. That would be all about it. Thank you very much. There is also I'm interested with very low frequencies. So for ham radio operators, there is HP119418, which is the near field probe, the old fashioned, 40 years old. So it's closed field probe from 9 kHz to 30 MHz, which covers all of the ham radio band of HF. And that could be also used for sensing the pattern of your antenna, although that device that is three-dimensional picture on the phone sounds for me much more interesting. Dr. Watch.
Yeah, by the way, I was looking up at the YouTube videos that you sent me, and although they really don't describe what the frequency range they're detecting, one was labeled VLF, an electric field. So for a full question of what frequency, I would assume they're somewhere roughly in the VLF spectrum.
Okay, thank you very much. That's all from me. That's all right.
Okay, thank you very much, Wesley. Bees are fascinating. Unfortunately, we've had problems with honeybees in the last 10-plus years, maybe 15, where there have been sudden deaths of many bee colonies. Apparently, the reason is multi-factor. There's no one single form, but there are all kinds of pestilence that honeybees experience. So they're bees and all the insects that fertilize all of our foodstuff is very important, obviously, and hopefully science will figure out a way to improve their chances of surviving and maintain the pollination that is required by all the flowering plants out there. So I thank you very much, Wesley. Once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We're here to listen and discuss the technology and science and all kinds of fun stuff. So if anyone has either a question or a topic or a comment, please feel free to hit that push to talk. Give us your first name and your call sign. Okay, I heard someone. Unfortunately, you were about 3% voice and 97% noise, so if you're able to kind of move your antenna, you know, change it from horizontal to vertical, or vertical to horizontal, or bring it closer to the window, or pick up the gain a little bit, we'd appreciate it.
W-A-2-C-D-L.
Hello, Andy. How are you tonight?
All right, I'm good. I've been listening on and off for a while. I have company, I have a friend staying with me for a few days who came in from, actually this time the Midwest. And his name is Roy also, I think I may mention that. So I got two Roys, and so we've been busy doing things. I got an interesting problem amongst all the other problems that I have, and it's very technical. I got to figure this one out, and this is going to be a little bit tricky if you want to hear it.
Certainly.
Okay, well, I'm not that versed in microcontrollers, but this is going to force me to learn something, which I don't regret learning, but it's going to take a little bit of doing. Amongst everything that I'm trying to fix and repair and get working, you know, there's an expression, when it rains, it pours, and everything happens at once. So we wanted to have, for my friend Roy, who's here, because we used to go on transmitter hunts back in the 70s when we got our licenses together on 10 meters. And whenever Roy comes here, we want to have a hunt. So we arranged that, and I have the what I call the bunny box, which is the portable transmitter which I hide, or someone hides, and we find it. And what happened was it stopped working. Never had this problem before. The bunny box uses a microcontroller, which is touch tone activated, and has a voice synthesizer, which is recorded in my voice. And it says, this is WA2CDL, this is an automated hidden transmitter, and so on. So all of a sudden, it stopped working. And I'm in the process of troubleshooting to find out why. And here's where the problem becomes a little bit complicated. Let me let it drop. Okay, this microcontroller was not programmed by me, but by another ham who had passed away many, many, many years ago. With much regret, his sudden passing was unexpected, and it devastated me along with other people because I knew this guy very well. He was very well versed in microcontrollers, especially this one. So he did the programming on it. I'm in the process of troubleshooting the touch tone decoder, because it will not touch tone on. You can't turn it. You could power it on. There's a switch. The radio will power on. The radio will key up manually if I press the push to talk button. But the microcontroller will not key the radio and go through its sequence that it's programmed for. Let me let it drop. Ed, I was going to give you a call, because you're familiar with the PIC, P-I-C, PIC microcontrollers. Maybe we can iron this out. So I'll just finish, because it is technical, by saying that I want to take one step at a time, which I started, to see if the touch tone decoder, number one, is receiving the signal from the radio, which it is. Number two, is decoding properly. It gives a binary coded output. There are four separate physical wires connected from the touch tone decoder to the microcontroller on four separate pins. I did pull up the specs on the touch tone decoder. Anyway, the logic levels of the touch tone decoder so far have checked normal. So my question I'm asking myself is, did something get corrupted in the program? Because the microcontroller is programmed to decode the touch tone sequence. It's a four-digit code. Four digits you punch in, and then it tells the microcontroller to then key up the radio and activate the voice synthesizer. It's not doing that. So I'm saying to myself, if the microcontroller is corrupted, How do I replace it? And that's when I said, Ed, I'm going to give you a call, but you came on anyway. So the timing was perfect.
I have a 5-second yes or no question. The fellow who programmed it any documentation or whatsoever.
And that's the best question to ask, and I already asked that question. I don't know. There is another ham who knew this guy, and I called and left him a message to call me back, because I'm hoping he left the source code with him and the documentation. If not, I'm going to have to track down this guy's wife and kids. Died back in the early 90s, by the way. It was due to a car accident. That would be, of course, the next question that I already put out there. And I wanted to tell you that, Ed, I don't have any documentation that I could recall in regard to any code, source codes, or any kind of programming that he wrote down. Otherwise, I'm going to have to start from scratch. Okay, Roy, do you want to add something to this, or should I just continue with Ed?
I only need about 30 seconds right now, Roy.
Yeah, fine, Ed. You have a lot of experience with PIC microcontrolling chip.
All right, first, the odds that it's the PIC chip that failed are relatively small. I think it'd be well worth doing a thorough troubleshooting of everything around it and making sure of that first. Carol will try to find out if you find any source. Can I find any documentation, ideally, but not necessarily the source code? I don't think there is any way to do anything except start all over with programming a PIC microcontroller from absolute ground zero scratch.
Yes, thanks, Roy. I agree 100%. That's the only way to do it. Luckily, I know what we're supposed to do. I know what the outcome is, what's supposed to... I'm not saying it right. I know what the outcome's supposed to be of the microcontroller to do its job. That I do know. But I'm keeping my fingers crossed that this particular touchstone decoder can give you a hexadecimal or binary coded output. You have a choice. I did do some research already, not knowing how it's connected, wired. I did print out the data sheet on the touchstone decoder, and I did come to the conclusion that it's in the hexadecimal mode, given that there's a pin on the touchstone chip that you either tie it to a logic 1 or a logic 0, which is a high or a low, and that will determine which state it's going to be in. So I did trace out the wiring. The signal is getting to the touchstone decoder. The first of four lines coming out is changing logic levels when I hit the correct digit. So that's working. I didn't do the other three because I got tied up. I got tied up with something else. I got to go back to it. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that maybe it's just a touchstone decoder that's not giving the data to the PIC, and the PIC is not starting up. If the touchstone decoder is working properly, then the next step is the PIC itself. The crystal oscillator for the PIC is working. I did check that. The crystal oscillator, which is a 3.58 color burst crystal, which they use for the touchstone decoder, is working. That's working fine. And as I said, the logic level so far is working on that. So that's where I stopped right now. I'll just do the time limitations. So I'm going to have to continue. Anyway, it is a technical subject mentioning this, and it'll be interesting to see what this turns out to be. Let me see. Ed, back to you.
Yeah, I do have some thoughts. First, okay, the crystal is good. Yeah, in the 90s when I was designing with these things, we always used 4 megahertz, actually a ceramic resonator, but this what I think this is fine. It's in the same ballpark, and it's oscillating, that's wonderful. But I think what really you have to do, if you want my help, sure, what you have to do is set up a test setup, monitoring the lines, actually inputs at the microcontroller, clear out by playing the generating a touchstone, decoding the touchstone, what happens at the inputs to the microcontroller, and see, yeah, when I send, when I press 1, this line and this line go low, what happens, you know, they make the truth table that sounds reasonable, and if it isn't, then your goal is to fix or replace that. Another totally different question on the output side, you're talking about a voice synthesizer. If that is resident on the ship, you have quite the entertainment ahead of you if you're rejoining the ship.
Let me clarify what you said. Yeah, the first thing that you said regarding the logic, the truth table, as I mentioned before, I already did that. It is decoding, and the logic level is changing when I press the correct digit. It's a 4-digit code. If I press digit number 1, not the number 1, you know, but the first, if I press the first digit of the 4-digit code, the logic is changing from 1 to 0 or 0 to 1. That's working. I got to check the other 3 digits. Digit corresponds to a different pin on the touchstone decoder. It's not serial data coming out. So the tick is programmed and strapped to see the 4-digit code that he used to turn it on. Four-digit code. So that's probably in the TIC program itself that looks at this and says, okay, turn on. As far as the voice synthesizer, it's a separate chip. I did not go as far as that just yet because I'm taking one step at a time. But I did remove the voice synthesizer circuit, or I should say IC, integrated circuit. I pulled it out of its socket. Luckily, everything's in sockets. So I pulled out that chip thinking that maybe there was a logic level that was stuck, that or got stuck on the voice synthesizer that was preventing the microcontroller from starting. So I did remove the chip, and unfortunately that didn't help. But again, getting back to what you said, as far as logic levels, I did go as far as to check the first digit, and that's working. The next 3 digits I have not checked yet because I had to do something else and I had to stop. I'm going to go back to that. So that's where I left off. Once I determine that it's not the touchstone decoder and it's giving the binary, the 4-digit code to the PIC, then I concentrate on the PIC itself. Okay, so we clarified on that?
Not 100%, but yes, your first step is when you have the time to finish your analysis. Is the PIC receiving, you know, the necessary inputs to operate? Now, here's one thing you haven't mentioned. You said you removed the chip on the voice synthesizer. Have you verified that the PIC is delivering whatever output is necessary to turn on the voice synthesizer? I mean, we're treating the PIC like a black box. It has the inputs, it has the outputs. Step 1, verify that all the inputs are following the protocol you expect. Step 2, verify when you put in the right inputs, you get the right output, even if it's only, say, one line going from 5 volts to 0 volts or something, and then the voice synthesizer is a separate issue. Provide the counter, coder, processor, voice synthesizer, and the key point is the interface between those two modules, which you say you still have a few more to do on the synthesizer.
AC2P.
Okay, I think that's Jeff, AC2PL, okay. Very good. Let me give it to Jeff next. And exactly, divide and, that's how I work. That's how I troubleshoot, divide and conquer. Take the first step. Is the decoder, touchdown decoder, giving the logic to the PIC controller? Where the PIC controller's program says, yes, turn on. And so far, what I've checked, yes, it is yes. The other, as I said before, the other three inputs I have not checked yet to see if they're changing. Of course, again, in the program, I would assume in the program of the PIC, the program says, okay, look for these three particular digits. That's what he set it up for. As far as what the output of the microcontroller does, like I said, and like what you said, number one, turns on a voice synthesizer. The voice synthesizer then sends audio, recorded audio, to the radio, and modulates the radio, of course. Number two, it also produces a logic level, which is the keying line, which tells the radio to transmit. That's not happening. The radio is not going into transit through the PIC. Or at least, I didn't check the logic level for the scope as of yet, but I don't think I would see anything because it's not keying the radio. And also, it turns on an LED. There is a transmit LED light which is added to the circuit, which indicates that the radio is in the transmit mode. That's not happening. So as far as the output of the PIC, no. As far as the input to the PIC, the one line that I checked, yes. The other three lines, not yet. That should basically clarify everything. AC2PL, Jeff, how you doing? WH2CDL, it's Andy.
How you doing, Andy? AC2PL. Troubleshooting any circuit, as you know, you start with all the passive components to make sure you're not shorting any line to ground through an electrolytic or a tantalum. I know you know that, but obviously this is stated not for your consumption, for the listeners. All of the passive components have to be checked first, and I'm assuming you did that, but skipped over mentioning that step. So that's step zero. Step zero A, actually. Step zero B would be pulling the PIC directly off that board before, you know. I know you would never do this, but I've accidentally fried so many components that I don't even want to mention it. Oh my God, I just mentioned it. Anyway, I would pull that PIC off the board and put it on the programmer and download the code. Even if you can't decode it, I would download it and make a backup. If you can't download it, you already know you've got a problem with the PIC controller. So that's step 0A and 0B, and I thought that should be mentioned. And I'm sure you've already done that, but you can tell the listeners. AC2PL.
Let me say something also. You enlighten me, and then we'll give it to Ed, with Roy's permission. I don't want to take up too much time because I know that Paul is probably waiting to talk about the space, the moon launch, which is now delayed because of a fuel leak and other issues. You enlighten me, Jeff, by saying, take the PIC out, download the program on a test platform and look at it. Okay, question, can I do that? And how can that be done so I can see? Do I have a PIC that's corrupted? That's what I want to know. Is there a problem? That's a question for you, Jeff, but let me give it to Ed.
But Ed, I'm sorry.
I can do that for you. Now, I believe I've checked. I am geared up with hardware. The only download program or download data, 14 thing chip. I believe you'll have a larger chip, so we have to build up a little, equivalent. It'll be the same circuit I have now, just with a larger socket. That's not a big deal. And yes, I would definitely agree, pull the chip, just try to download it. Keep in mind, when you download the chip, you get just machine code. Can be helpful, but as to go from that with nothing else is very, very difficult. I mean, it's very, very... The reason they invented source code is because that stuff is so hard to follow. postcode is humanizing that stuff. Not humanizing is very, very frustrating, but it does have its purpose. Now, let me go back a little bit. I want you to check all inputs and outputs at the pins on the chip. You're assuming that some of, like, for example, the circuitry from the chip to the transmitter is working. Make no such assumption. You're getting the outputs from the chip and the transmitter is turning on. Now it's right up your lane. And final thought, if you're not doing touch function coding and you're not doing voice synthesis, I could recreate this thing from scratch. It sounds relatively simple. I have the tooling and the capacity that we can sit down, figure out what it has to do, generate a program, check it out. So it's not the end of the world if you're not doing the voice synthesis or the tone decoding, because those, to my opinion, are real nightmares.
Okay, very good, WHCBL. Yep. It will not be such a nightmare because that's an extra peripheral that's added to the controller. I'm talking about the voice synthesizer chip with its components. And yes, the output of the, from what I traced out so far, the push-to-talk line, which tees up the transmitter, is directly connected to the PIC output line that they're using. There is no circuitry in between. As far as push-to-talk is concerned, it's just all you do is ground it. If I ground the push-to-talk line, the radio will key up. I did check that. So the PIC is not doing its job by grounding that line. Okay, that I verified as one of the first things to do. So I don't see any other circuitry in between. It's direct. As far as I can see. Again, I don't have the schematics for this. I have to trace it out. And, using logic, I've been able to do that. Looking at the underside of the board, that everything is wire wrapped together. So, okay. That's where I stand right now. I don't think it will be a big deal. By the way, this is a... I did not download the data sheet on the PIC controller as of yet. I want to do that. I want to see what the pins on the microcontroller are, how they are labeled, and what their functions are, and how the programming of those functions. I have yet to do that. It is an 18-pin chip, 9 pins on each side, and I believe it uses flash memory. I believe this is not a one-time programmable chip, which I understand. I think by the number, and I didn't write it down, but it's a common C18 such and so on, 18 lot of, you know, whatever number is after it, which is, I believe, again, using flash memory, which means you could erase it, reprogram it, and all that stuff. It is not one-time programmable. That's from my knowledge of what I remember. Okay, back to... Boy, let me give it to you, and thanks for letting me in.
You're quite welcome, Andy. I hope you solve your problem. Big microprocessors are interesting things. They don't have a lot of internal memory. Early ones, I think Ed knows better than I, something like 128 to 256 bytes of data is the only thing that's restorable in an EEPROM memory. All the other memory, if necessary, is addressed externally. So I wish you good luck with it. The 4-bit output of the touch tone is called a nibble. You know, 4 bits is a nibble, as opposed to 8 bits is a byte. Yes, Ed.
You are somewhat mistaken, and I will tell you the following. I have been consistently blown away with what you do, dollar part, with those big controllers. I have never come remotely near a fraction of the memory on the chip. Then again, I'm doing stuff that back in the day would have been done with lodging gates and flip-flops. I'm not storing huge amounts of data or anything. I'm just doing things. But if you want, me to give an example of what I just did a matter of months ago? Those things? I think my phone is entertaining.
Sure I would. I mean, you know, back in the good old days, people prized their ability to write machine language code in a very concise, small, highly effective manner. Nowadays, with gigabytes of memory, we're all rather sloppy about it. But another point that I just want to mention is it probably is a major pain in the backside to dump, even if it's 128 bytes of data. Take 128 bytes of data of pure machine language and translate that into anything that makes sense to know if it's been corrupted or not. So, you know, that's a problem. But Ed, I would love to hear you.
So typically, these controllers have either 2,000 or 4,000 lines of assembly language code. By the way, I deal with them in assembly language. They do have a C compiler, but the problem is I do not like to do them in C because you'll lose time. I want to know that it's going to take 4.2 microseconds to do this. The C is everything bit. With the assembler, you can work it out. You know the clock, you know all the divisions, you know the number of lines of code that you can exercise, and it tells you exactly how long it will take to do such and such. So let me tell you what I had. I take nominally a 120 volt 18 hertz line. I step it down either to a transformer or resistor divider. The beauty is the transformer gives me isolation. The resistor divider, I have to have a floating ground off of the neutral and then just optoisolate on the output, which is the neutral, but they both have their pluses and minuses. Put in what is nominally 0 to 5 volts, 2.5 volts represents 0 volts on the AC line, and you have this sine wave coming in. And it is routed to an on-chip A to D converter. But first, I take newer chips as a built-in 8 megahertz crystal oscillator on chip. I don't think it's really crystal, but it's pretty accurate. And you can even tweak a little. And what I did is I take 50 cycles, I break it down into 32 samples, which comes out to be something like 521 microseconds, and I generate a consecutive structure that runs every 521 microseconds. So 32 times a cycle, I do an A to D conversion of the greatly reduced voltage, and I save it, and then I accumulate them over, I guess, 4 or 8 cycles. The reason I have 8-bit registers and a double precision 16-bit register, kind of, I should 15, 4 bits, you know, 4 cycles or 8 cycles worth of data. And I accumulate all of this stuff over, say, 8 cycles. So far, so good?
Let's just jump in a second.
Go ahead.
Okay, because I just feel bad that, Jeff, AC2PL, you still listening?
AC2PL.
Oh, okay, I know that Gazette is talking to Lloyd now about, you know, the stuff that he did. I just want to thank you for your input from what I was talking about. Anything else you just want to add before I give it back to them?
Roger, thank you very much, Andy. I use the kind of inexpensive Chinese TL-866 TIC reader and programmer, and I think that has 40 pins, so it would handle really whatever you kind of throw at it, and it's been successful in a variety of programming steps that I've done for older equipment.
Okay, I'm not sure what Ed uses, but I'm interested in obtaining one of those so I can play. Can you give me the information again? Or maybe you just want to email it to me and I'll write it down. Or I'll just, you know, look at it.
Yeah, roger. Tango Lima 866. Tango Lima 866 is the machine. And, I mean, there are drawbacks to that as well, but we can discuss them offline. ACTPM.
Okay, I'd like to know more about it. All right, thanks. Okay, is that it? And then I'll give it back to Ed.
That's it for now. And the only time, I think I've actually written up one usage of it on my QRZ page. I programmed a pick for one of my IFR machines, and I think I also used it for a an oscilloscope to for the LaCroix oscilloscope. I used it to add the FFT functionality. Anyway, it's a nice device. It works, and with some limitations. AC2PO, thank you.
Okay, very good. You mentioned IFR. I got a bunch of those. That'll be coming handy. All right, I'm going to look that up and do some research. Thank you. Okay. I just wanted to tie the ribbons on that because I have to leave. I got to attend to my company here, too. Roy, thank you, and Ed, I'll be in touch. But I want to get this going. I really don't have time for this. I got so many other things to do, and this happened. And it's really just something. Everything happens at once. Roy, back to you. Thanks, WHSCDL.
You're welcome, Andy. I hope everything works out. I know you'll find some solution to this problem.
Yeah, I hope so, too.
Okay, Ed, would you like to continue telling me this?
First, did you follow where I was, or should I go back?
I believe I was following you where you were.
Yeah, one thing I realized, I forgot to mention, is I do an absolute value when I take it out of the AGD converter. So if I'm above zero, I see above 2.5 volts in the zero. If I'm above zero, the most significant bit is one. If I'm negative, the most significant bit is zero. And I use that to generate an absolute value. So if I'm negative, I flip it. So now I'm basically keep detecting it. And then what I'm doing is over eight cycles, I average it. And now here's when you jump up and say, yeah, but average is not RMS. But the beauty is, this is a power company sideways, which is a very decent waveform. So it's a fixed multiplying fudge factor to go from average to RMS. So I put in the multiplying factor, and now I generate a number, predicative, of the HCRMS voltage. And then I tailor that to the next stage, which in one case is I generate a proprietary, out of my own mind, serial data stream to go to the next stage. Or it could just be run through G to A to drive some kind of an analog output or a display. But I did not program it to drive a display directly. But it certainly could. So are you following all that?
Yep, I think so.
And the beauty is I had enough hardware and time left over. I could do this for multiple channels, and it would all fit in the program space, like 2% of the program space, 1% of the scratch pad RAM, 0% of the non-volatile RAM. I didn't need it. It had the built-on clock, and I even had basically a CFO increase the frequency of the clock, which is good because go through the math, an 8 megahertz crystal still not work, but I was able to increase it
that's not Sean. All right?
Yeah, I mean, that sounds fascinating. I mean, these PICs, they're not really microprocessors. I think they're designated as microcontrollers.